This is Whitley Strieber. At the edge of reality, there lies an unknown country, a realm of mysteries and truths and the unexpected. If you do not wish to travel in this country, stop listening now. But if you hunger for high adventure and information that others dare not tell you, then welcome to Dreamland. Welcome to the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we've got James Fox, one of the legendary documentary filmmakers of all time, and certainly in the whole UFO space. 1997, UFOs, 50 years of denial. 2003, Dynamite, out of the blue, his friend Peter Coyote's first time narrating for him. Then more, the phenomenon in 2020, a phenomenon in and of itself, Moment of Contact in 2022. And now, just now coming out, the program. James, welcome to Dreamland. And where can we find the program? First question.
Okay, thanks so much for having me on, Whitley. I appreciate it. So the program is in the Genius link. It'll be Amazon and iTunes or Apple TV. It's also PopNet for international, I'm told. But you can go to my Twitter, or formerly known as Twitter, now X account. It's at James C. Fox. And you can get all the details there at James C. as in Charlie Fox. But it's Apple TV and Amazon. Just Google it.
I saw the program with a huge audience, not a huge audience, but a very excited audience, I should say, at the Soul Foundation conference a couple of months ago. And I was absolutely blown away by the unbelievably powerful sense of conviction that comes out of that documentary. But we're going to get to it in a bit. I got to go back to what you've done. I know you're going to Brazil soon, and you've already done that documentary on Varginha, Brazil. Can you tell us a little bit about that situation?
Absolutely. Do you want me to back up a little bit and talk about how that film came about? Or
Yeah. Let's go ahead and back up. Talk about how that film came about.
So, funny enough, when I was making Out of the Blue, and by the way, after Out of the Blue, I did a 2-hour special for the History Channel called I Know What I Saw, and that came out in 2009.
Right.
Yet another one. It's about that National Press Club event I did with Leslie Kane. But in any case, when I was making Out of the Blue in the late 90s, we started, I had this partner, British guy, Tim Coleman. And Tim and I were doing sort of broad stroke, you know, ideas of, hey, we should cover this case. We talked about Bentwaters. We were like, hey, we got the 1997 Phoenix Lights. Let's do that. Check, you know. And then he goes, oh, yeah, mate, there's this absolutely phenomenal case. It just happened just a few years ago in Brazil with these live aliens and the UFO crash. And they're walking around the town. And I thought, oh, my God. Yeah. I picked the wrong partner. I literally said that. I remember thinking, I might have to cut this guy loose because this guy's crazy. And I just completely refused. And I remind your audience, I was doing my second UFO documentary at the time. And I'd heard about it. And I completely refused to read one thing about it. No way, impossible, didn't happen. And fast forward probably at least 10 years, at least maybe 12. And I was in my early 40s and I was going to Brazil on a completely unrelated matter. I got invited to speak after I Know What I Saw came out in 2009. So I got invited in 2011 or something. And right before I was leaving, I get a call from a very good friend, sort of a mentor and someone who's been incredibly helpful over the years. He's extremely high up and well-respected in the entertainment industry, Jeff Sagansky, who I had tremendous respect for. And Jeff says, oh, you're going to Brazil. We're on the phone together. Going to Brazil. You got to look into that Varginha UFO crash case. I'm telling you. And I just, out of respect to him, I kind of just said, yeah, sure, Jeff, I'll look into it. But I said, I'm not wasting 1 second on that ridiculous. There's no way that happened. No, you know, click, hung the phone up, not going to do it. Went to Brazil for the first time. AJ Javard invited me. And I met this guy, Marco Leal, and a number of other folks and researchers. And it might have been firsthand witness, someone that came, a lot of witnesses throughout the town of Virginia. Some people saw the military activity. Some people saw the creature. Some people saw, you know, heard about the UFO crash. Everybody's got a slight piece of the puzzle, or someone's cousin's brother, or X-ray technician, or somebody worked at Humanitas Hospital, or, you know, Regional. And, but I met some people there, and it really, and Stanton Friedman was there too in Brazil. And Stanton's like, oh yeah, there's something to that case. You should look into it. So I started looking into it, and I, paralleling that, well, that's when it first started, paralleling that effort, I was launching the phenomenon. I didn't have a title for it at the time. And so my intention was I was doing cases all around the world. I did, you know, Socorro, New Mexico. I was focusing on Rua, Zimbabwe, the landing at aerial school, 1994, you know, Varginha, Brazil, 1996. I went to China. I went to Australia to cover the, 1966 Westall primary school case. Phenomenal landing case. My gosh. So I was just
That's a case that's not known all that well at all.
It is absolutely staggering. There were 300 plus witnesses standing outside at recess, roughly 10 o'clock in the morning, including the teachers, including the science teacher, Mr. Greenwood, all the kids, the primary school, watching this disc. And some say there were two, some say there was just one. But it was a disc darting around the sky above them. And there was an airplane from the local airport interacting somehow, was curious, flying around to look, get a closer look at this thing. And then it landed right near the school, like out in the field where they have a track, where they actually run around this forest. And some of the students jumped the fence against the will of the teachers and ran to the landing site. We interviewed those kids. It's really, I mean, how many cases do you get to interview people who came within, you know, 8 to 10 feet of a landed UFO in broad daylight? I mean, that's, you know. So anyway, so I was doing all these cases, and Varginha was one of them. And I spent 8 years making the phenomenon. And towards, I don't know, maybe the last 6 months of production, I was like, I can't squeeze Varginha in. It's just not working. And so I deleted it. And I remember the day I deleted it. I worked on it, oh my gosh, so hard, and 5 trips to Brazil and all that translation. And it just wasn't working. I just couldn't squeeze it in. It wasn't working. I had to do what was best for the phenomenon and cut it. And I remember it was like a gut punch the day I did it. I had to almost close my eyes and hit the delete button in the timeline. And it was like this guttural kind of, you know. But I was like, all right. And then, of course, all my counterparts over in Brazil were like, where's Varginha? We've been working on this for years. Where is it? I said, I'm so sorry, we're gonna have to do a documentary solo on just on that case specifically. There's too many moving parts. It just was too much. So I went back to Brazil another time after the phenomenon came out, against the will of some of my really close comrades, fellow researchers. I won't mention their names, but they were highly dubious of the case. And and all the hard work and boots on the ground from the Brazilian researchers and coupled with my tenacity, and we made a whole movie on it. And I'm absolutely convinced that it happened. In fact, more evidence just keeps coming every day. I'm constantly getting contacted. We just had a FOIA request. I won't release the details on that because we're going to do an updated version of the film. I'm going back to Brazil in a couple of days. It's an ongoing. I think it's the best crash retrieval case involving the Americans in modern history, and certainly the most well-documented. And yes. With all the discussions that are all happening right now with the testimony of David Grush and more recently Lou Elizondo, you know, testifying under oath to a bipartisan group of lawmakers that there's a crash retrieval program and biologics, aliens, right. I think it's the most relevant case. And so we're going to update it to 2025 and re-release it in a few months.
My new book, the reason I brought it up is that in my new book, I describe it as maybe the most important of all cases for a very specific reason. And that is what happened in the hospital.
Yes.
Oh. When the doctors.
Oh, okay. This is one of my, I have a number of regrets in my career. Okay. A number, but one of the regrets on the higher end of things, when I was filming in 2013 in Los Angeles, and I had a laser-like focus at the time on Rua and Socorro, but Rua more so. And with the help of Randall Nickerson, we located the witnesses, the children from the aerial school in 1994. They were now adults. And brought them in from all different corners of the world, and they all, it was a massive undertaking. My God, it was a miracle that it happened, but it did. And I was very busy in Los Angeles at a production place filming all of this, right? And I get contacted by Roger Lear. And Roger Lear, Roger Lear is super at it. He goes, I heard you're doing Virginia. And I'd only been at Virginia for a couple of years at that point. He goes, I heard you're doing Virginia. I said, yes, I am. He goes, you got to get me on camera. I need to talk to you, you know. And I said, yes. I said, yes, Dr. Lear, yes, it's going to happen. But I can't even tell you how busy. I was doing 17, 18-hour days. I'd lost my voice because I was trying to get everybody together and make that whole thing happen was nearly impossible. I was dealing with Kim Arnold, Kenneth Arnold's daughter, flying her in. She's a lovely woman, but boy, was she difficult to deal with. And, oh my gosh. I could tell you that you'd fall out of your chair laughing if I told you some of the things that happened trying to get her to go on camera. Oh my Lord, people have no idea. I mean, really funny stuff. But in any case, so I'm dealing with all that stuff at the time, that window in Los Angeles. And Roger Lear's contacting me. Now, what he didn't say to me was, I have cancer and I'm dying and I have critical information about that case that you need to hear from me. Because I was in the room. Yeah, so he gets frustrated and I was like, I'm so sorry. Please don't take it personally. The window that you picked is just, I'm overwhelmed. Had he said that he was dying of cancer, I would have stopped. I would have done whatever it took. Interviewed him at midnight, whatever. So he said, well, if you're not going to get me on camera. And I said, no, it's not that I'm not going to get you on camera. So let me tell you, I went to Virginia. I have all these tapes. Here, take them. Boom. He gave them to me. So I got all the tapes. I had them transferred. And I don't remember the exact span of time this all took place. But I had them transferred. And then I found out. And then I sent him back the tapes. And then I found out that he died. And again, I don't remember the exact time frame or what year he died. But this was...
Yeah, I remember too. But I have to admit, I think it was... The late 90s?
I was in correspondence with him in 2013, no question.
Okay, so well, all right, then I'm wrong about the time.
So I got the tapes back to him, and he died. So I was just, shit. I was laser-like focused on getting the phenomenon out. I kept cranking. It was a monumental effort. I won't bore your audience with the details of that. Doesn't matter. But I got the film done, and I got it released in late 2020. And as I just said earlier, I ended up having to delete the entire Virginia case out of the film because it just couldn't make it work. It's too much. Right. So I decided to do a film on just Moment of Contact. I'm doing the film. I think I started production in 2021. Shoot, I went to Brazil in early 2022. I think it was 2022. And shot whole new series of interviews and tracked down new witnesses, got some unprecedented on-camera stuff that's amazing, never before seen, like majorly good stuff. And I'm in post-production right here behind me in on the East Coast. And I was like, ooh, Roger Lear gave me those tapes. I had them digitized. What did I do with those? And I dug them up. They'd been sitting on ice for, I don't know, the better part of 10 years. I got the tapes out and I'm going through it. I'm like, wow, there's some good stuff here. This is impressive. And then I was like, I have to get his book. So I bought his book. And the book basically is a transcript of the taped interviews that he did. And I know that I had the tapes and I had the book. So like it was almost verbatim. And then it gets to this one case in the book, not on the tapes, that it lines up with everything else that had been going on. The book was, like I said, it was a direct translation from all the tape stuff, primarily interviews and stuff like that. And he had a field translator. It was Ubenajara Rodriguez, who was the lawyer / UFO investigator, amazing human being. And he had a son that was absolutely bilingual, like fluent. You know, there's fluent and there's bilingual. This guy was bilingual. And he would do the translations on camera right on the spot. Just like, it was very impressive. Ubenajara's son. So they apparently had this meeting, according to the book, with two doctors. I believe it was Humanitas Hospital, okay, in the city of Virginia. And
yeah, that's correct. That's where it was.
Yep. And so there was Roger Lear was with another fellow doctor from Los Angeles, I believe. And I have his name, but I don't have it in my head right now. And I'm reading this going, oh my God, if this is true, this is the most amazing thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. It's the centerpiece of my new book, of The Fourth Mind.
Okay, so let me tell you, I was so frustrated. I tried to get in touch with Ubenajara, refused to meet with me at the time. That might change. I'm trying to find the doctors, couldn't find their names. I obviously couldn't get the information out of Roger Lear. He's no longer with us. What about his friend? I contact his friend. I eventually get an email or a phone call back from a family member. He is deceased. It's like, so now Roger Lear is deceased. The other guy that was in the room is deceased. Ubenajara Rodriguez and possibly his son was in the room as a translator during this interview with the two doctors where there was alleged communication telepathically with the beings. All this stuff's happening in the damn hospital. And I didn't end up featuring that in the movie because I didn't have anything but words in a book.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do I do?
So that's what I used.
Yeah, I know. And look, and Ubenajara Rodriguez, up until fairly recently, has denied that it happened. But I know that Roger Lear, I mean, I've talked to people that are like, look, man.
No, it happened.
If Roger Lear put it in the book, you could take that to the bank. Now.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going
to
take
that. My book is dedicated to Roger. Roger is a hero.
I know. Believe me, I'm kicking myself and I will never stop kicking myself that interview didn't happen. And I just, my God, he was in the room with those doctors and I could have gotten that on camera and I didn't. And I failed and I'm so upset about it.
Oh, listen, we all miss the mark in this thing. It's maddening. I can tell you, I can go back across my life and tell you of 10 incidents. I even got a chance to go with the visitors and to be with them. And I turned it down. Listen, we gotta take a break. I'm already late, as I always am. So no one will be surprised on my end of this thing. Okay, we're going to take a little break. We'll be right back. My new book, The Fourth Mind, is on sale on Amazon for Kindle and paperback right now. The audiobook and hardcover are to come later this month. But why is it called The Fourth Mind? Why is that? Let me explain. First, I go into detail about the bodies, brains, anatomy, genetics, and beliefs of our visitors. And as you will see, there is reason to believe that this is accurate and the first time ever that this has been discussed in any significant detail with any degree of real accurate finish. Then I show that they have abilities like telepathy and levitation, which we don't. Or do we? In the second part of the book, I show how we did have those powers, but lost them during a huge catastrophe 12,000 years ago. Was it some kind of bizarre war? A natural catastrophe? Whatever it was, it nearly destroyed humankind and left us in a state of shock that we suffer from to this day. I call the powers we lost the fourth mind and show how we can make a serious start at getting them back. Get the fourth mind. It's step one on our way to the stars. I want to make it. I want our children to make it. Mankind belongs as part of this cosmos, expressed into it like so many others across the reaches of the stars. Why not us? Of course we belong. The fourth mind. Get your copy today. And as always, I stand ready to answer your questions on unknowncountry.com in the comments section, or send me an email at whitley@streber.com. I'm right here. I'm not a celebrity. I'm one of you. I'm just like you. Believe me. That's why I know we can all do this. We're talking to James Fox, his dynamite new documentary, The Program. Awesome. I've seen it. And I tell you right now, when you see it, two things are going to happen. First, you're going to think, well, I knew this. And then you're going to think, but he's made me realize just how important all this is. How important it is. It's an incredible documentary. It's brain bending. Okay, well, I think we can wrap up our conversation about Brazil.
So, yes.
You're going back. That's the key.
Yeah. So, yes. But let me just. So when I finished Moment of Contact, right? I don't know if it was 12 years or 13 years from concept to completion. I was obviously convinced that it happened and that the Americans were involved, because I had heard rumors of the American involvement. But the last visit I was in Brazil, Marco, and I don't remember the last name, Fernandez or something like that, who was a flight control officer, like basically the radar guy, control officer that monitors incoming flights into Brazil, in the whatever area that he was monitoring at the time. And he went public the last visit I was there. And it was like, wow, this is amazing. He's like, yeah, I watched this USAF, he kept saying, flight come in. I'm like, USAF? Oh, United States Air Force, of course. And it didn't have Brazilian government authorization. And a higher level military official stepped in the room. Now, I'll remind your audience, in Brazil, the police department worked for the military. The fire department works for the military. You're doing flight control officer, you work for the military. And so a higher level military officer walked in the room and said, let the plane land. It was going to go, my understanding, into Sao Paulo. It was diverted. It went to Campinas. Makes perfectly good sense. January 20th, 1996. And then from there, two helicopters flown into Varginha, January 20th, 1996, into Varginha. Huh? And then back to the airplane. They loaded something on it. Poo! Back to the United States. Case goes cold. So I was like, wow, that's a pretty high level of confirmation of the Americans' involvement. And I'd heard that from a number of people, but not the guy that watched the plane land. So I was like, wow. So when I came home, back to the United States, I got the film out. I was going to go after that lead, try to find anyone that was involved with that flight. Well, little did I know, 5 months after the release of Moment of Contact, there was going to be a high-level intel officer, David Grush, testifying under oath to a bipartisan group of lawmakers that there's a crash retrieval program that we recovered biologics. Whoa, this guy just opened the door for me to go knocking on, because look, I'm going to look like a crazy guy, because I remember when I first got back, from my last trip to Brazil, and the movie hadn't been out yet, I was still putting it together. Leslie Kane was here with CNN. Turns out later it was National Geographic. They were doing a whole series. They were interviewing me in this barn for a couple of days. They were here. They were like, we are so excited. You just got back from Brazil. Oh my gosh, you got to tell us what you're up to. You know, I was like, yeah, no, not going to talk about it at all.
Right.
You're going to look at me like I'm crazy. Okay. I had my neighbor who runs Make-A-Wish here, and he's a great guy. He's actually friends with Brian Bender. I love the guy. And he goes, you know, you got me with the phenomenon. Wow. Phenomenal. That's just such a good film and really compelling. And da 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 da. And, but I'm afraid, James, you've lost me on Moment of Contact. I mean, live aliens walking. This is a bridge too. I'm sorry. You lost me. I'm kind of almost to the point where he's like, I've lost all respect for you. And I said, look, I totally understand. I get it. I know where you're coming from. Just watch it. Just listen to the testimony. Okay. Don't take it from me. So in any case, so when I started the program, it was personal, and the door was open for me to ask those types of questions to sitting members of Congress, which I never thought in 100 million years I'd ever do. Hey, do we have spaceships and live alien and aliens recovered? You know, I thought I'd be shown the door and I'd be ostracized to eternity for ever asking another question on the Hill. But instead, they answered those questions, and it's just phenomenal. I mean, look, you've been at it longer than I have. I've been at it over 30 years, right? And I've got the films to prove it, but I never thought we'd ever see this day where you have, you know, unprecedented legislation. I mean, look at the NDAAs that have been signed in 2023 and 2024, the National Defense Authorization Act. They've got legacy program talking about it, recovered materials, analysis, reverse engineering. It's all right there. It's unbelievable what's happening. And at the last minute, Kirk McConnell, Senate Armed Service Committee staff member, investigated, who's been on the Hill for 37 years, but he investigated in particular the UAP issue from 2017 to 2024. And he came forward and talks about, you know, how many roughly, I think there's 8 or maybe 12 firsthand witnesses, firsthand, not David Grush, firsthand, that went and met with, you know, senators, staff members in a skiff and gave the specific details. And he said that was a rather sobering moment, moments for himself, like seriously, and other senators. In fact, I would highly recommend, if anybody hasn't seen it, I did a Reddit thing with a woman where they brought all the different various communities in Reddit. And we did a 3-hour presentation with Len Val Logan, who's part of the UAP task force, and with Kirk McConnell, who's never come forward before ever. The program is the first time ever. And he puts us in the room with firsthand witnesses and describes the atmosphere. It's posted on my X, or formerly known as Twitter account, which is at James C. Fox. And I can't overstate just how significant that moment is, listening to someone who sat in the room in a skiff listening to firsthand witnesses, when the expression on senators' faces and all that stuff, it's amazing.
I'm making a note here.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll try to get a link to that in our in the show description, folks, so you can get right to it. So here we are at this juncture in this thing. Hal Puthoff is beginning to do a lot of public interviews, which is something I've been after him to do ever since I met him in 1987, I guess. We've been friends a long, long time. I'm going to tell him he's got to interview with me or I won't pay for his breakfasts anymore.
I tried to get him to do the Reddit thing and he goes, yeah, no, I don't think, no, not right now.
He's in a very interesting position in that he's got a lot of this. I mean, a lot of it. And he doesn't want to be in a situation where he is being recorded or live and ask questions he can't answer.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. That's why he's reticent to interview with me. And I say, Hal, I know all the questions you can't answer, like the back of my hand. I won't ask them.
Yeah.
I'll get him one of these days.
Well, it's interesting because I tried to get at him for a long time and it was no, 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 no. I respect your work. No. And I think it even at one point, I was going on Joe Rogan and a second time, and he's in Austin, Texas, and Hal is in Texas as well. And
he's in Austin now. He lives in Austin.
Yeah. And so I begged, pleaded, you know, and he agreed to have lunch with me at a bistro in Austin. And he said to me, no cameras, no cameras. I said, oh, Hal, of course I'm not going to ambush you with a rolling. No. Yeah, of course. Me. I'll, you know, put me through a metal detector, whatever. We had a lunch. And it was like maybe 2 p.m. And I loved him immediately from upon first sight. I was like, I loved his whole aura, his everything about the guy. I was just, wow, this guy is one of the most unique individuals I've ever met. And he ordered a glass of champagne. So I ordered a glass of champagne, and I'd just done Joe Rogan the day before. Moment of Contact was just, Moment of Contact maybe had been out for a couple of months. But in any case, we got along really well. And I said, gosh, you know, I'm doing this new film, you know, blah, 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 blah. What do you think? And he thought about it for a year. Okay. For a year, maybe longer than a year. Maybe it was a year and a half. I couldn't tell you exactly. And then I was doing interviews in Washington, D.C. and traveling with a crew is really tough going on and off air, going through airports and airplanes. We have a lot of gear and tripods and sound gear and cameras. And my gosh, it's a lot of work going through the security. And so if
it must be horrible.
Oh my gosh. You only do it if you absolutely have to, you know, and you try to do it like, in any case. So I was filming with a whole crew in Washington, D.C. for, I don't know, several weeks. And I actually was my second time. And then we had interviews lined up in New Mexico, one in Nevada, and then we had another one in California. So I said, hey, I got a big Suburban. I rented it from Hertz, and we drove it across the country, and we went straight from D.C. all the way to Texas. We just bombed it, went straight through. It was pretty intense. And I did all the driving, and I arrived at his house, and he said to me, Hal said, you know, 5 minutes ago, I didn't think I was going to do this. I just nearly killed myself getting here, you know. He goes, 5 minutes ago, I was thinking, I don't think I'm going to do this, you know. And so, and then he ultimately gave me the interview, and he said, I'm doing this for my grandchildren.
Yeah, that's what he's thinking about these days.
Yeah.
Right. And it's, you know, what we all think about. Jesse Marcel thought about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you get older, like, you know, I don't want to go down that path yet. I'm still healthy.
Well, I mean, look, I've lost some of my best friends. In fact, I've lost 6 really good friends. I lost some in their 20s, some in their 30s, some in their 40s, some in their 50s, some in their 60s, some in their 70s. So quite honestly, like no matter really what age, like one of my best friends was 20 years older than me, 20, 24 years older. We were like brothers, man. I loved that guy. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, if you're lucky to live to the ripe old age of whatever that ends up being, it's all over in the blink of an eye, right? I mean, it's just a nanosecond, like a little flash in the pan is a lifespan. And it can end prematurely at any moment. And I'm acutely aware of that because I've lost, you know, both my parents are dead, lost all my best friends pretty much. My really dear friend Amy just died of cancer. She was 42, never drank, never smoked.
Beautiful
children. Like, I mean, super healthy, positive, unbelievable.
Well, so, it's, you know, that's what my doctor said to me when we first were getting acquainted. He said, I have to warn you, I've got 100% death rate in my practice. I knew I was going to like the guy.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny because I had to go in for the full inspection. And I said to my doctor, I said, you know, I was bent over the table and he's got the glove on. And I said, whatever happened to dinner and a movie?
But I'm a person, I've got a lot of stuff that my uncle and my dad were both involved in this. I don't to this day know how my dad was involved, but he was in some way. they lived and died without saying a word. And most of the people who were in this in the old days, in their time in the 50s, did the same. The Jesse Marcells and the Phil Corsos are the absolute exception. Those guys died with their boots on and their lips zipped. And I come from that world. Now, in my case, I'm thinking to myself, maybe I should open up more than I have. I don't know.
I just want to know where the bodies are.
Yeah, a few of them. Let's get on now. We're halfway through the show.
Yes.
And you know, I ought to take another break. And folks, instead of taking a break, I'm just going to beg and plead with you. No, I need to take the break because I want to show his trailer and I want to show the Fourth Mind ad, because Fourth Mind is out now, and I would be very behoove you to read it. It's never been anything like it in the world. We'll be right back. My new book, The Fourth Mind, is on sale on Amazon for Kindle and paperback right now. The audiobook and hardcover are to come later this month. But why is it called The Fourth Mind? Why is that? Let me explain. First, I go into detail about the bodies, brains, anatomy, genetics, and beliefs of our visitors. And as you will see, there is reason to believe that this is accurate and the first time ever that this has been discussed in any significant detail with any degree of real accurate finish. Then I show that they have abilities like telepathy and levitation, which we don't. Or do we? In the second part of the book, I show how we did have those powers, but lost them during a huge catastrophe 12,000 years ago. Was it some kind of bizarre war? A natural catastrophe? Whatever it was, it nearly destroyed humankind and left us in a state of shock that we suffer from to this day. I call the powers we lost the fourth mind and show how we can make a serious start at getting them back. Get the fourth mind. It's step one on our way to the stars. I want to make it. I want our children to make it. Mankind belongs as part of this cosmos, expressed into it like so many others across the reaches of the stars. Why not us? Of course we belong. The fourth mind. Get your copy today. And as always, I stand ready to answer your questions on unknowncountry.com in the comments section, or send me an email at whitley@streber.com. I'm right here. I'm not a celebrity. I'm one of you. I'm just like you. Believe me. That's why I know we can all do this. We're talking to James Fox. His new documentary, The Program, is absolute dynamite. In fact, James is probably one of the most effective documentarians in this whole space in the world, if not the most effective. I saw The Program at the Soul Foundation conference a few months ago and blew me away, even though I pretty much knew the whole story. So let's get into The Program, James, and spend the rest of our time together talking about it. First of all, I want to ask you just it's almost a creative question. Mm-hmm. It's not that I did not know what this was about, but it still just completely blew me away. It is fantastically convincing. You come away from that realizing the truth. Tell us about how you did that. I'm just fascinated by the way the thing builds. It's marvelous.
You know, I have a very tedious process. People often say, oh, I'd love to, because I'm really, I have so many deficiencies in my life in terms of like capabilities, you know, and but I have some strengths, and I have discovered a model that just works for me. It's a lot of work. And I have people come in, oh my God, I'm so excited. I want to come and see your edit studio and sit in on a session. I'm like, are you sure you want to do that? Okay. And they come in and after about an hour, I look over there like, I think I saw that scene 100 times already. Yep. You're going to watch it another 100 times. But what I do is I'll take all the information, and I don't pre-script anything. And some people think I'm nuts. I really am kind of winging it in the field. And it's a very unconventional way to go about things. But I think ultimately it makes it a little harder, and it makes it, but it also makes it a little better, because none of it is, it's all the documentation, all the documentary is unfolding in real life. Like, it's really happening. I don't stage anything. Or maybe I'll say something on camera as I'm doing it. But do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
I'm really in the field, and you're watching me in the field ask the questions and learn about stuff. And so it's not generally, I mean, it's not a very efficient way of doing documentaries, because you really are kind of out there winging it. And you could probably do a lot more shooting than you would necessarily do with a more refined and laser scope project, right? And it's also personal for me too, because I've had boots on the ground in the field uncovering, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind and now crash retrieval programs, Roswell. And I'm thinking about all of these things in production, and paralleling that, I had one of the most diabolical situations happen. I won't get bogged down with boring your audience with this, but I had the most diabolical issue happen financially with my last distribution company. And they just took almost all the profits I made for Moment of Contact and robbed me blind. And it was absolutely catastrophic.
You weren't the only one who was robbed blind by them.
Unbelievable. Like, I had all these plans. My family never had a house paid for. My dad lost his house 20 years before he died. My mom never had owned a house. She lived in a trailer. Like, and I was like, one of my goals was like, and I've got a beautiful home, and I'm not complaining. I feel very fortunate that the phenomenon had gifted that to me. But I was going to pay the house off for the first time. I was like, I made the sales. I was all excited. Like, the goal finally in my life is all I've ever wanted in life is to own a house free and clear, you know? Yeah. Anyway, so all that's going on, it was horrible. And it wasn't just 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. It went on for over a year and a half, and the uncertainty of it all. But during that time, all that frustration, I want to say anger, more frustration, just the emotions, it was very intense to deal with. I would fall asleep at night. Sometimes I'd just have a big shot of whiskey just to fall asleep because I was so stressed out. I'd wake up in the morning and I remember looking at the ceiling and I'm going, God, I had this horrible dream last night. It was just, then I'm waking up going, oh my God, it's not a dream. It's really happening. And the uncertainty of it all, because it wasn't like, oh, it'll be over in 2 months or 3 months or 6 months or a year. I didn't know. But in any case, I finally got to the point where I just said, all right, I'm going to borrow the money I need to make this film. I'm going to concentrate all my energy into creating a really good documentary. And that's what I really set out to do. And I worked up to 17, 18-hour days in the studio right behind me. I mean, I worked myself. Honestly, Whitley, I think if I worked any harder, I thought I might die.
No, my God.
I know that sounds like I'm being melodramatic. I'm not. I remember at times thinking I'm going to fucking die in my sleep if I work any harder. And I worked, and I also felt this sense of urgency because the information is so poignant and relevant now. It's current, right? This is happening now. Like,
yes. All
the other docs that I'd made in the past primarily were cases that happened in the past, right? And this was unfolding now. That's why podcasts are so great, because you can get witnesses on and stuff. But I wanted to record this moment in history, you know, and I think that we succeeded well in that. And a lot of people say, oh, well, it's a big nothing burger. I didn't learn anything new. It's like, well, actually, I didn't cater this for the hardcore UFO enthusiasts, even though there are some nuggets of stuff within that as well, like one of the best photographs ever taken in the history of a photograph of a UFO in my home. Yeah. The Calvine UFO stuff is amazing. There's all kinds of new stuff on that.
You know, well, you have more stuff in there, though. I think the Carl Nell material.
Fantastic, right?
Yeah. I mean, it really is. I mean, it's a... people who say things like that, they, you know, it's bullshit. They're not going down the right path because the power of it is just overwhelming.
And then you ask, like, my response to some of these people is like, hey, I get the criticism, but fair enough. But do people look at you and your family like you're crazy when you start talking about crash retrieval and live aliens? Show them the program, and then they won't look at you as being so crazy because I packaged it in a way for the mainstream audience to really get a grip on what's happening right now, this unprecedented moment in history. And that was the intention of the program, was to take, it's happening now, support this incredible effort among our bipartisan group of lawmakers, support them. I can't emphasize that enough. They need to hear from us. They want to hear from us, like that we have their backs while they're poking around doing this stuff. In the past, it hasn't exactly been a career enhancer. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that was my intention with making the program, and I'm very happy with it. I like it a lot. I enjoy it.
Well, I'm getting all kinds of texts from somebody. You know, we still have these fires here. It's an ongoing issue.
And I'm so sorry, Whitley. That's terrible.
Oh, man. I have to tell you, James, there was one point where right down the street from my house, I could see flames coming up above the edges of the Santa Monica Mountains. I never thought I would see anything like that in my life. And I thought to myself, we went under a Category 3 evacuation. We had to get out. I thought, I wonder if I'll have a home when I come back. And so many thousands of people wondered that too and didn't when they came back. And, you know, when I see all these trolls on Twitter, I don't call it X personally, exulting in our suffering, I just have to tell you, I don't want to get off the subject, but
yeah,
here the...
I mean, it's catastrophic. I mean, the whole, it's absolutely...
Oh, man.
I can't... Okay. My dad's house burned down when I was a kid, but I didn't really live with my dad at the time. I would stay with him over summers, and it was absolutely devastating. We went down to eat dinner in the local town. It was a small town in Northern California, little coastal town, a fishing village or fishing town. And we were downtown eating, and we heard the sirens, and never in 100 million years thought those sirens were our house, but they were burning to the ground, like at dinner. And so, you know, you have your whole life in a place like my barn, like all the history of my whole life, all the recorded, all the photographs, all the birth certificate. I mean, everything, like my films, my hard drives, like my computer. It's unimaginable.
I'm so downsized. I could walk out of here with only one thing. You'll notice she's not, folks, on the wall right now. It's the communion lady that I've got in safekeeping. But the rest of it, I've got family photographs I will take with me. The rest of it, no, I can walk away from this place and just start anew. I have to be honest. Listen, I'm on a lot of different threads, mostly on Signal. And I always ask before I start a podcast about the guest and say, you know, you have any questions for him? And here's a question for you that I think is interesting.
I didn't realize this was live.
No, it's not live.
Oh, it's not. Okay, sorry.
I asked them before I do this.
Got you. Okay.
I'm. It's not live. No, don't worry.
I would have checked for food between my teeth if I knew it was live.
Oh, yeah. I'm kidding. Don't make us hungry. anyway, excuse me. I've gotten a lot of bad air here lately.
Oh my gosh.
Pardon my coughing, folks. Oh, excuse me. Chuck Clark video.
Yes.
You have any further information on that? Because it seems to have gone silent.
Well, so George Knapp's probably not going to be happy with me revealing this, but okay. And I love George Knapp. I adore the guy.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine too.
Absolutely love the guy. And I say that kind of somewhat jokingly, but when I started talking about it again, and I don't remember the exact year, it might've been 2019, maybe 2020, not entirely sure of the exact year, but in any case, I'm going to leave out all the specifics because the specifics don't matter. What matters is we got a hold of Chuck Clark after 20 whatever years. I don't know how many years it was, a lot of years, and with some help. And he had left the little alien because he lived near the little alien in Rachel, Nevada, in
right
for forever. I don't know how many, 15 years, 20 years, whatever, long time. And I would call the little alien periodically and check in. And he was pissed off with me because once he showed me that footage right after it was taken, I pestered him for, 10, 15, I don't know, years. And I remember the last time I called him, he said, if you ever ask me again, I'm going to cut you off from, you're never speaking to you. And
wow.
And so I did the 2-hour special, I Know What I Saw. Or maybe it was the second version of Out of the Blue. I'm sorry, I'm trying to remember. And I remember talking about the video with this producer, and he goes, hey, man, I can get 30 grand. If it's what you say it is, 30 grand. I said, well, I don't know. I was told that if I reached out to him again, he would never speak to me. But I did it anyway. And Chuck, that was it. He cut me loose. And he... a man of his word, he said he'd never speak to me again. So indirectly, maybe 10 years after that, I'm going to say a guesstimation, we get back in touch with Chuck indirectly, not through me. And Chuck says, I still have the tape. So I was like, and he'll show the tape to this other individual that I was working with at the time.
You need to wait. Let's back up because I think most of my listeners don't know what this tape even is.
Okay, so back in the 90s, I was doing my first documentary, UFOs, 50 Years of Denial, and I was working with Chuck Clark out at the Area 51 region because Chuck was an amateur astronomer, and he had found all these various vantage points from the mountain range to spy on activities at Area 51, and he'd seen some objects in the sky exhibiting a technology that to him was impossible. And he was very curious about it. And I included that in my first UFO doc. We did some analysis stuff, whatever. And so we were in touch for several years, often, very often. And one day out of the blue, he calls me up and he says, James, I got something to show you. And I said, and I lived like 12 hours away. I was like, what? He goes, well, I could talk about it on the phone, but I can tell you that when you see it, your jaw's going to hit the floor. I said, that good? And he goes, yeah, it's that good. So I stopped everything I was doing. I jumped in my car and I drove straight through to Little Alien from Northern California. And I got there and he takes me into his double wide and he pops his VHS tape in. And I see, the quintessential sort of road trip with two guys that are like, driving along the extraterrestrial highway or posing in front of the little alien and just goofing off, talking about UFOs, whatever, listening to music, road trip, out to the little alien. And then they're parked and it sounds like they're kind of arguing in the car about something that's over the top of them. And then the inside of the car, and I don't know if it was a couple weeks old when I got it. And when I got to see it, there was like, the resolution was great. It didn't have any dropout. I mean, it looked good. I saw like a light that lit up the dashboard and the light, the shadows on the inside of the car, I just remember were kind of moving around in a way that I'd never seen that before. So the light source had to be kind of doing this because the lights on the inside were kind of, and then one of the guys gets out and against the will of the other guy, and he films a little, orange yellow disc that's just kind of wobbling in the sky, not that far away. It's just kind of doing this. And the guy goes, oh my. Well, at first I think he's having problems with his battery, but it's still filming. And then he goes, oh my God. Oh my God. Like that.
Wow.
Really high pitched, like, oh my God. And then bam, the camera shuts off. And I look over at Chuck and I went, where did you get this? You know, and he tells me this story about these two kids, and they came out to Little Alien and they had dinner and whatever. And then they left to go back to Cali, to Los Angeles. And I guess they had the encounter somewhere around the black mailbox, filmed it, and then shot back to Little Alien, something like that. So fast forward all these years later, maybe it's 2020. It could be 2021, but I think it's 2020, maybe 2019. And we get a hold of Chuck, and Chuck's to my, in fact, the last time when he said, I'm never going to speak to you again, he goes, I don't even have the tape anymore. So I thought at that point, maybe he didn't have the tape anymore. He goes, and I'm never talking to you again. And by the way, I don't even have it anymore. I thought, well, that's weird. Why would he not have it? Anyway, so turns out he says he does have it all those years later, and that he would be willing to show it to this guy that, you know, so I called George Knapp, and I was like, George, there's this footage. You remember this guy, Chuck Clark? Oh, yeah. He goes, I did a story on Chuck Clark. His place got raided by the feds when he was poking around at Area 51, and I did a whole story for the news station I was with.
Oh, wow.
The 90s. But he goes, I know him. Yes. I said, well, you know, you've been covering flying saucers in Area 51 for quite a while, and I saw some footage he has. It's pretty damn impressive, and apparently he still has it. So George says, I said, I would highly recommend you get it. Don't mention my name, but I would highly recommend that you go see him. And so he goes, okay, cool. I'll do that. So 1 week goes by. I texted him, and I said, hey, have you gotten in touch? I'm really busy. Okay. Another week goes by. I texted him again. He goes, I'm busy. I was like, all right. Another week goes by. I was like, did you get in touch with him yet? I just had the sense of urgency. Like, it needs to happen now. And I'll tell you the relevant part of that in a second. He goes, stop. You're not my damn wife. Stop harassing me in a nice way. I love the guy. But I was like, okay, I'll stop harassing you. Well, he never went. But the other gentleman did. And Logan Paul, whatever. So he goes out to see Chuck Clark. And Chuck gives the name of the individual who gave him the tape. And apparently it was a guy that worked in production in LA, and he had a master, maybe it was like a Beta SP master, and he made a VHS copy from the original or from that. I can't talk. I'm sorry. And so he had just died. So had George Knapp gone out when I told him to, George Knapp would have gotten in touch with the guy that gave the footage to him, to Chuck Clark, and that guy had the master, which I'm assuming is on a Beta SP, or could have been high eight, but I would imagine since he was in production at a TV studio. So we ended up getting in touch with the gentleman's son. He had just died. And the gentleman's son at the time was like the last, you know, he was mourning the loss of his father. The last thing he wanted to do was go look for some UFO tape. And I unfortunately let it kind of go at that point. But I was devastated because I was like, you know, and then about, I don't know, maybe a couple years later, there was a guy that got in touch with Chuck Clark, was getting a lot of attention in the media. And he came by my studio, again, long story, and he had the dirty version of it that was like 25 years old, dropout, lots of dropout. It was like, you know, 30% of what I remember seeing in terms of resolution and quality. But it was still, you know, the disc and everything else and the talking, but it had been pretty well degraded. And so now I'm told that there's certain software that can clean up the dropout that happens on half inch tape, particularly VHS tapes. And that at some point it's going to be released, but that's all I know about the footage. And Logan Paul was considering releasing it. It's not great quality, but then Chuck Clark made it abundantly clear that if you release that, I will sue you. You're in my house filming illegally. Logan Paul's got a lot more to lose, I guess, and didn't want the headache. and didn't think that was the best, the footage was that great anyway. But you talked about the disc doing that, and that's it. That's the story, unfortunately. And I actually went, I think in 2023, to the Little Alien, and I spoke to the daughter of, I think it's Pat. There was Joe and Pat. Was Pat. Joe passed, but Pat's still there. She's quite old now, and her daughter is probably my age. And her daughter said to me, and she was really not that engaging. She just didn't want to talk about it. I was the Chuck Clark. She grew up with Chuck Clark there. She saw the footage 1,000 times. And I was talking to her about the footage. She didn't really want to engage on it. And then I was like, I just think that, I'm worried about, for preservation purposes. I mean, a VHS tape is degraded. Da, da, da. And she looked at me, this is like a year and a half ago. She goes, you think we're that stupid that we didn't make a copy? We're that stupid? Like, yeah, that. And I was like, well, do you know the person that shot it? And she was just, I don't know what happened, man. I don't know if they got a visit. I don't know, man. I don't know.
Yeah, they probably got a
visit. Very, very frustrating. That's that story, And I gave you the truncated version because it's much longer than that. But if George Knapp had gone to see Chuck, he would have most likely gotten the master, a copy from the master.
Yeah, I bet he did. Well, I'm gonna ask him and find out.
Well, no, he didn't. George Knapp never went.
Oh, he didn't.
Nope. The guy died. And I had this sense of urgency. I always listened to that inner voice was just screaming at me. Now, go now.
Yeah, I get that a lot too.
Go now. It's now. I had the same thing when I interviewed Colonel William T. Coleman, who was also like public spokesman for Project Blue Book, after he had that dramatic encounter in a B-25 over Alabama in 1955. And I remember nobody had ever gotten that guy on camera, like an extensive, like on camera, professionally shot interview. And it was so significant because you got this guy who was a World War II pilot, colonel in the Air Force, public spokesman for Project Blue Book. But in 1955, he had one of the most dramatic encounters, daylight encounters with a flying saucer you've ever heard. And I remember at the time I was like, just starting production with the phenomenon. And I was like, I got to go to Florida. I got to get this guy on camera. And I remember the guy that was funny at the time. He was like, James, cool your jets, buddy. Like, relax. We're going to go do it. I was like, no, we need to go now. No. Anyway, I wouldn't shut up. Finally sent a skeleton crew out there, filmed him, got it all on camera. And then he died a couple months later.
Well, at least you got it on camera.
That's my point. Exactly. That is, I listened to those interviews.
Exactly. You got to do it. You got to do it. Let me ask you this. It's an unusual question. What if you knew for certain that people who directly were involved were interfacing directly with this mysterious presence that we're all trying to figure out were watching you right now? What would you say to them?
What do I have to do to avoid the anal probe? No, I'm kidding. That was a joke.
That was a mistake. Try again.
I'm kidding.
I know. I know you're kidding.
I'm going to tell you something that I never.
Be serious question. So be serious.
No, I know. I'm going to be serious. I'll be serious. I was kidding. I'm sorry. My jokes don't always land. But
I'm sitting on that joke.
Okay. When I was editing the contact at Aerial School, I spent more hours editing that sequence than I think any other sequence I'd ever done. And I had this incredible moment where I'm thinking, gosh, I'm one beat away from the entities communicating with the children, and I'm getting directly from them to me. It was a very profound moment. Like, I felt closer to the phenomenon than I'd ever felt in my life. And it was late at night, and I went outside on my deck, and I'm looking up at the night sky. I'm just having a breather, getting out of the edit room for a minute, as I do. And it's maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, and the phenomenon spoke to me. And it said, would you like us to reveal ourselves? And I got scared. And I said, no. And I think to myself, I had this opportunity to potentially communicate with the phenomenon. It opened up the doors for me. And I was too scared. It was scary for me. The unknown part of it was.
Yeah.
So I think I would actually ask them, why are you here? What's your agenda? Because
that's the question.
Yeah, because I have to, you know, I have to come to the conclusion based on all the field research I've done, and there's so many people that have done so much more than I have. I'm not tooting my own horn. I'm just saying that if they wanted to reveal their identity overtly, and they've done some pretty brazen stuff, but if they wanted to reveal their presence overtly, all they have to do is hover over the Macy's Day Parade or the next huge football game.
They can do it in 5 minutes, and they don't.
And they don't. And
they're not going to either.
And they've done, but they've done some pretty brazen stuff. I mean, look, Phoenix Lights, Hudson Valley, 1952, two consecutive weekends over Washington, D.C. I mean, that one right?
They're in a position of getting us acclimatized. We are a wild creature in their, in other words, we've tamed horses and dogs and cats and so forth. We're not tame, though. We're wild. And from their standpoint, they're looking at a wild creature. And this whole long period is a process of taming us to them. And I mean, it's not like breaking a horse. It's more like getting us just used to them.
Yeah.
And that they are amenable. In other words, they're here. They're not going anywhere. And, well, you know, you notice something about how they work, and you can understand a little bit more. Right before the drones showed up, there was a huge thing going on about whether or not we were about to have a nuclear exchange with Russia. There was going to be nukes in Ukraine. Then the drone story dominates the media for 3 or 4 weeks, and the nuclear exchange issue is gone. There was something done there. That wasn't an accident. So people say, what are they doing? They're doing a lot is the answer. A lot. So
I remember Salas, one of the most poignant statements I'd ever heard come out of the mouth of a military witness. Love Robert Salas.
Me too.
I remember, and I knew why he was a launch control officer, because he was so measured and calm.
Yes.
He just had this really calming voice. Like, that guy could read a book and put me to sleep in a good way, not a boring way. He just got this air, just amazing. And he said to me, I'll never forget it. It was probably the late 90s or maybe it was early 2000 when we were doing Out of the Blue. And he goes, you know, James, the way I see it, it's almost like taking matches out of the hands of a baby.
Yeah. That's, he said that to me too, actually.
Yeah. And it really,
my show a while back,
it really just deeply affected me. Like, wow, I never thought of it like that. You know? Yeah. Anyway,
The last question about the phenomenon.
Yes.
I want folks to finish the podcast and go buy it and watch it.
The program.
Did I say the phenomenon?
I know it's so easy because it's book TP, right? The phenomenon, the program. The program. Yeah.
Well, there's something about being pushing toward 80 that makes you do things like that. It's very annoying. For my new book, I had to learn genetics from the ground up at my age. And it was intense. But anyway, let's get back to that. I don't want to go off that down that path. The phenomenon. What single thing can you say that will get us to go out and put our money where our mouth is and watch this thing? Because it's terribly important, folks, that you watch it. It's important for many reasons, some of which I cannot tell you. That we do this, that we engage. You can't sit passive anymore. You've got to engage, and the visitors have got to see you engaging, and they will see you in a completely different way than we see each other, but they will see you. So James, do it. Yeah. Sell the show.
So I'll have to answer that question with a question to certain specific members of your audience, people watching this. Let's just, and I've said this before, let's suspend judgment for a moment and imagine if it's really true. Of course, I'm convinced it is, and as are you, that the government is withholding definitive proof that we are not alone. Bodies, spacecraft, things of that nature. How significant of a discovery would that be? It wouldn't be just significant in the United States. It has global implications, right? And it's so deep and so profound that it could affect the lives of every man, woman, and child on this planet. Now, there is a grassroots, unprecedented effort happening right now that are highlighting this moment in time of a push of transparency unlike the likes of which we've never seen before. And at the very least, let's continue and see this process through. And the program is part of that grassroots effort. And if you like to support it, then go out and rent it or buy it. And you can support more grassroots efforts like myself and what you're doing and the whole UFO community. I don't think we have anywhere near the level of support that we should have during this moment in history.
Great answer. Great answer. Beats the probe answer all to hell.
Yeah.
James Fox, the program, a huge and extraordinary achievement. James, all I can say is thank you, and my hat is off to you for what you have done. It is really something. And have a marvelous time in Brazil and bring back some gold, as I know you will.
I'll do the best I can, and I cannot thank you enough for all your support and all the things that you've done. You've paved the way, people like yourself. So thank you.
Well, thank you for that, too.